John, if you don't mind, I'm going to quote you that, but I want you to go to know, I don't know what I apply to.
Let me tell you the purpose of this meeting, I want you to know, there's this meeting. It's this, I think all this crap, you know, I told Nelson, she's going to know, you know, Chris in their lab, you know. I said, you remember, we had a hell of a flap, because who's going to get the credit off the Japanese tax money? And you were mad, you thought you'd done it. Some people said, I said, I'm going to get banned, because we both did it. And I said, now on this house, and we want to talk the same way, and on this, but on this, we were talking about trade legislation in terms of the taxes and all that sort of thing. What we want to do is to work with you folks, and sure, go to an administration program. But we know that we can send an administration program down there, and unless, for example, you on the Senate side, as the leading Democrat, and Bill's on the House side, if you're not for it, it ain't going to get through. So in other words, what we want to do is to work out a deal, and it doesn't mean you and Bill's voice for either. We want to work out a situation where we can cooperate with the congressional leadership, Democrat and Republican, and getting programs that we can get through. Let me put it another way. I can send out a whole lot of tax reform measures, welfare reform measures, and then beat the Congress over the head for failing to pass it. I'm not going to do that. I want some action. I'm not just going to make politics with it. Really, that's my deal. And so therefore, before we send things down, it doesn't mean we're going to give to tell you that if you're against something, we're not going to send it. We can't do that. But we're going to at least convince ourselves that this doesn't just run totally against what the Congress will do. So that's the deal we're going to have. And incidentally, if we get a tax bill at the end of all this, the two main areas that I mentioned, it is going to be one where it will be joint credit.
But
the rest of you want to do it together.
What I really think you ought to be against, and I know I'm just adamant, is just making bad things happen to it's some little nameless guy over there, or a little clip of people over there, but you don't know who they are, and I don't know who these characters are. They were there before you came in. For all I know, they were there before I came to Washington 24 years ago. But they damn well get together. They got some of their gang that migrated over here to the Washington newspaper. And they just clatter and scurry around and shout about what you ought to do and what I ought to do. We don't even know who the damn people are. But they get themselves somebody in the executive branch, some secretary, somebody over here. They come over and have to keep their position. And they come and tell you, well, here's what we want to have to keep. So, well, now time falls on the hill, say, well, Mr. President, now, you know, we're willing to go along with part of this thing.
Yeah.
Part of it, we want to do it all. And here's how we think it ought to be changed. Now, the whole thing is, you all know how it can't be changed. You've got to die every hour and cross every teeth. That's not your position. That's not our position. And when those people succeed in doing that, they usually succeed in preventing anything from happening.
Which is the story of,
you know what it is, it's the invisible government.
Yeah.
And it goes on and on, regardless who's president. I drank
by an imminent policy, or letting down an ally, or running away because of the demonstrators around here, because the colonists, the remedial giving you hell. He fails to do the right thing. Everybody's in his snack rage for peace and all the rest. You see what it does? Your allies lose their trust in you, but even more important, your potential enemies, the Russians and the Chinese, lose respect for you. We've got to think of the fact that years down the pipe, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the leader of China, the leader of Russia is going to look at this office. And what I had to go through in these past 4 years, particularly these past 4 months, means that whoever's the head of China, Russia is going to respect this office because they feel that, well, the President of the United States has a lot of power and he might use it. You see, that's what it's all about. So it's respect that we're talking about here. It's respect all the way through. Well, I digress. But the point that I make is that in terms of this this whole area, if we can work out ways that in this so-called invisible government, who of course don't give a damn about respect, they only say, and look, we don't care how you do it, the president was wrong. Johnson should have done this, and he didn't follow our advice. Fine, so Johnson was not wrong, but right in the follow our advice. I was right. You were right, not to follow their advice. But as far as the invisible government is concerned, now that they weren't elected to anything. That's what they forget. The bureaucrats weren't elected to anything. Chancellor wasn't elected to anything. Severi wasn't elected to anything. And yet they act as if they speak for the country. What the hell, you were elected. I was elected. We speak for the country, correct?
Thanks, sir.
And for that reason, we've got to stand up against this sort of stuff.
Well, you're the only one who's been elected by all the people in the whole country.
No, 49 states.
At least the 50 of us, at least 100 senators say that we were elected by people of 50 states. But you were elected by all the people of the entire United States. So when you elected, you're the only one in the position they were. Now, I was elected by all the people to do this job.
Well, on these people down the river, we've got to just talk to each other all the time. Otherwise, they're going to surround us.
What I'd like to do, Russell, for tell you this, I want you to establish a direct communication with John and this stuff. If you think something naive, as I said, you have pleasant terms of family. And not only on these things, but on other matters that may involve in your interest. And we will talk to you directly. Wally Bennett, so totally understand this. Wally will come down to those recolonization meetings. And what we would like to do is to work together before we send out a tax thing. We're not just going to call you in. We will, the bipartisan leaders, agree on what we're going to do. But we'd like to talk to you in advance to enlist your cooperation we want. Let you, for example, take the lead in some areas where we may not feel that we can. But we can work out that kind of a deal without compromising the right of either to go an independent route. There are times that you're going to take one that I wouldn't be able to take, that I may take one that you want. But I think if we could work that, that would be good. But you think so? Fine.
Good. Oh, all right, Sergeant.
Now, Senator here.
He just here.
Really lobbying me for family assistance to River Cup.
Is that what you said?
I was lying, in favor of his inaugural address.
Can I suggest this, John, that you will set up, if Senator Russell has the time, I want you to set up this, as soon as Weinberger has a meeting, for you and Weinberger and Russell to sit down and have a little talk about it. In other words, in all these plans, and get Lenny, because it will involve it, on this housing allowance thing, which might, if we get a housing allowance,
do we want to let that gel a little bit?
We're not ready for it.
We've got some checking to do.
The thing
we've heard is that it puts great pressure on rents. Rents and housing prices tend to go up, so we need some kind of controls to avoid that. And the British have worked this out. We're going to go take a look and see how they're
doing. Well, I want to mention that. The point is that we're not limiting our consultation with you on the bills that just happen to be in any kind of way.
Right.
If that's all right with you.
Right.
But you see, if you get the bill there, you cannot really discuss welfare or something about stepping out of the game. Because when you discuss welfare, it's for the poor. You can't discuss welfare without discussing food stamps. You can't discuss welfare without discussing housing. You can't even discuss it without discussing transportation.
is just a crime. And I think we've got a tax break for the elderly. That's a very technical thing. We'll try to get some plan down. I haven't looked at one. We'd appreciate your consideration of that.
Both of those cars are cost us some money.
Now, when it comes to the balance of the tax, I mean, say that it cuts across a lot of areas. And I don't want to, and I want you to know that, and I mentioned others that are talking about it. One of them, Russell's Energy. Talking to George Schultz the other day, he was talking about a job that we're going to have a big energy broker. But you can't have an energy broker without getting to the tax thing. Another of them is in the field of trade. You find it in a trade deal. That has tax implications. Of course, you've got a trade deal, don't you? Financially.
Yes, yeah. As long as...
Well, this is not going to take more Congress.
Well, I put it just like this, Mr. President. You can move two ways on trade. You want to go by way of trade, to be ratified in the Senate. You got to have a two-thirds majority in the Senate. You got to go to the foreign relations committee. If you want to go by way of an act of Congress, which is your alternative, you can do it either way. You want to go by way of an act of Congress, and either to implement it, but or authorize you to make one, or authorize you to amend the law. Then that takes a majority vote in the two tax writing committees. Fulbright right understands that. He's seated moving toward our committees. I think that you people right to do it that way. He's going to give anyone a majority of the session. I'm not going to do that. I think that everything that's all right for me if you do anything you want to do. Over here, I can't keep down for you here when there's anyone over here, but I'm not going to refer these trade bills to them. Administration draft, so they go to finance, because at least I'm not planning to. My view would be, well, go ahead and hold yourself here and take a position on it. But if you want to, if you can do anything, I can't keep up with that.
That's like a president's work thing, I can say. This is a reflection on all the members of the Foreign Relations Committee. But on the trade bill, I want that drafted so that it does go to finance. And also, another reason for that is that you've got, it basically is that they are more responsible people. And if you get over in foreign relations, you'll have a lot of jackassery. So we can't draft it that way.
Hell,
let's do it.
You'd be foolish not to, because that can't go there with all those ideas there. That'd be trying to hold a trade bill hostage. I think you do something in your foreign relations there that you
try to sell.
There's not enough left to go with.
Now, on the tax reform areas, let me get your feelings on that. Of course, as I say, we'll be talking to, we've already talked to Nelson. Nelson, I have here, as he says, for how long? 4 or 6 weeks.
He's having these panels now, so he's going to have a bunch of public witnesses. That's the way he's in opposition. The Treasury will come up at the end of this year, which will probably be in the middle of April.
Well, let's start then with this bedrock proposition. I've got to be for those two things. Beyond that, my mind is open. Simplification on foreign, of course. And, of course, I've got to be for any tax measure that will help us on the energy thing. So if it's the right kind of tax, tax. Beyond that, the mind is open. And I'd like for you to just give us the feeling as to what, where, how do you think we ought to move on?
Well, I think I'm too aware of the kind of distinction that Ms. Mills has in mind. I told his county he's got mind of doing a little something about some reform of the inheritance tax structure right now. You reduce the rate, but you cut down, and you also reduce what they can give away to charity, but cut that in half. So they can't give a half of the estate to charity, which means private foundation.
What do you think?
Well, it sounds like a good proposition to me. You know,
exactly.
One reason, so frankly, I think I can go along with that. One reason that people pile so much into these foundations is that the tax rate is prohibitive if they try to leave it to their heirs. And so we just don't get anything out of it.
The only foundations are her away, we could separate out the damn foundations so that the charities were churches, colleges, and so forth.
Yeah.
I prefer private colleges, frankly, than public colleges.
Yeah.
You gotta have both.
Yeah, sure.
But so I don't like to see any some of the big ones,
yes,
are engaged in activities that are shocking.
Well, that'll be dealt with. Now you get back to fundamental thing.
this, Mr. President, that if I just take it off Newgate, it's not going to have a problem. Because you say, all right, now for all Newgate, it's discovered thereafter. We have the reason that you can't, there's several reasons why you can't get enough gas. But several of the reasons why you can't get enough gas were imposed right here in Washington. For example, here you've got a superior fuel. It's a superior product. If you won't let the man producing it sell it for what it's worth, you won't let him charge the same price that the guy's charging for the interior product. So you're hurting the guy with the interior product. And the guy with the superior product does not have the incentive to go produce it because you won't let him sell it for what it's worth. In fact, anybody would tell you that if you've got something that's a good product, it's the best. Then if they won't let you sell it for what it's worth, just keep it up, just hold on to it until those people wake up. So now you can't get enough gas. Let's close the school rooms down. Can't even tell the generator plants out of my way that because the gas is so cheap, they're all generating gas. Can't have the gas cut down, so then they start having the brownouts and all that. Well, now people say, my God, why didn't somebody do something? What's the trouble? What trouble was it? That you told that these people knew the damn stuff was worth as much as a similar number of BTUs produced with coal and oil. It's a superior product, and they can't even get what the inferior product is selling for. So they ain't just don't produce it, just keep it right where it is, insofar as you possibly can. Now, if you want to produce it, you ought to give the incentive for them to go out there and sell it for what, just sell it in competition with the other fuels. It's a superior fuel. Let them sell it for what it brings to market, which is what coal would bring and what oil would bring on a BTU basis. If you do that, I don't think anybody can really argue about that very much, especially now you've got the Washington Post over here to say that that's correct. Now, it does mean to sometimes, but even a blind hog finds a big one once in a while. So some guy that's a Charlie Walker finally convinced him of that. But anyway, now, when you do that, I think that sooner or later, you're going to have to let the price of the existing gas come into line. And the reason you're going to have to do that is because you don't do it. Those wells are just not going to cooperate. They're going to sit there and let those wells sand up. They're not going to rework their wells. You've got one well over here on this side, on this lease, which is under an old contract, and we let the lease over on this side under a new contract rating for twice the price. You say, well, that well sand on up until we'll produce a damn thing. Hopefully we'll be working on that one. Produce it out of hole over here, well, it's the same gas, but you get twice as much coming out of hole number two as it does out of hole number one. So I think that you'll have to either let them have it on the old gas, or you have to give them a phasing for a period of X number of years that you can go ahead and bring it up in the line, something like that. I don't see how that you can let people who've got gas under a contract which says that they can get the going market price be denied and adapted the right to have what the contract calls for. So I think the price is worth it. I think that you can phase it in to cushion the impact, but I don't see how that in the long run you can deny somebody the right to sell that part for what it's worth in a free economy. Now, as far as your oil is concerned, as I said, I thought about that. It seems to me that if you buy the concept, which I think is correct, that the security of this nation, not only the security of its commitments to the free world, means that not only do we have to be able to produce our requirements of fuel in the event that we can't buy it from somebody, or that anybody can keep it from being delivered here, but that we can even take fuel to friendly nations that don't have their own. To see them through it, we did at the time of the Suez Crisis, and we had to divert our stuff over to Europe to help them to go to war for your fuel. We'll provide you with some fuel if you just won't wait for Egypt. Well then, so that they had no good excuse to go to war against Egypt. Well now, when you have to do those kind of things, it seems to me that you're going to have to maintain domestic fuel. And all the thing about keeping the oil in the ground is just so much longer. It would take you 5 years to ever get the well through it. take your seminar, it's time to build a plant that you got to make out of shale or out of coal. You either got, if you're going to be ready for an emergency, you can't predict when it will happen. And that being the case, you've got to have an industry that's ready, able, and actually operating in order to do it to meet your emergency. You can't wait 5 years in the emergency is to get this fuel. You've got to have it fast. And so you've got to have an industry that's capable of producing it. My thought would be that I'd say, what percentage of the energy requirements do we propose to produce here in this country? Pick a figure, any figure you want. Offhand, I mean, you can say 75%, but you can say 70%. Pick any figure you want. What percentage will we produce here? Now, when you take that figure, I think that when things settle down, you're going to have to let the market determine both the price and the supply. In other words, if the price is right, the supply will come to it. You take all these people without shale, they've got to keep us going for 500 years out there, or maybe longer than that. But they're not producing any oil from it because our people keep saying, well, keep the price of oil low enough so that these fellows won't have any incentive to bring the shale in. Well, if you're going to be needing the oil from the shale, you're going to let the price go up and come up to where the shale will be produced. Now, solar energy right now is not economically feasible. It's a practical matter. In most of the country, you can't justify atomic power. You can produce it cheaper with your standard fuels, with fossil fuels. But if you let the price determine what the market's going to be, let the price determine the supply. Then I think that the whole thing will come to line, and you'll be able to, the market, the price will bring the supply, whatever you want to maintain that amount of your market, let's say 75%. Now, with your imports, if you want to, you can use that, you can charge a price on the tickets that will support a stockpile if you want to have a stockpile. That'd be find a way to pay for it. Say, all right, now, you've got to carry a stockpile adequate to carry us through an unforeseen stretch of bad weather or a mass emergency where we have to go to help a foreign country. And so, you stockpile some and you got to proceed to the emergency and you make the ticket, bear the cost of carrying the stockpile. I think you ought to also keep those small refineries up with you. If somebody's interested in the atomic war, that's all you're going to have left to refine anything. With all these big, magnificent, efficient coastal refineries being gone on the first day of fighting, in all probability, it's not going to be gone within a week. You can't defend them. The easiest target on earth is it. There's the easiest here, there's a great big tanker a mile long, so that you can't count on that, the only refineries you can have. Those are small things located out in the Hudson. Where things are moving up and accomplished to find them.
Up and down that river of yours.
Well,
all refineries in Louisiana.
Well, I hate to say it, but you can't count on those Louisiana refineries to see through the nuclear war. Tell me it's on, they're too easy to hit.
It goes out a couple of shots.
Oh, yeah, they're efficient as can be now, beautiful efficient refineries. They'll be gone. Now, those things would be good for the kind of limited war. And hopefully that's the only kind of love I have to fight. Hopefully we won't have to fight any. But the best way to avoid having to fight one is to be able to fight one, it looks like. The kind of people that can live in this world don't seem to give us much support for the fact that we're not going to fight and are not able to. So I just think that whether you like it or not, you're going to have to let the price of energy go up. Until the price will bring our stuff in. Now, people in my part of the country, when they're talking about 50 cent gas or 90 cent gas, which is all of which is below what you pay to bring gas in from foreign lands in New York, man, they get so excited. All these poor devils that have gone out of the office just want to go back into it. Say, my God, you pay that price for gas? I think I know where I can find some. But obviously, if you can't sit here for 17 cents, they can't make any money at that.
That's what Georgia's economist calls elasticity of supply.
Now, let me suggest two things here on the energy one, John. You know, on the boys, you would be sure that there's always a concern on somebody's ideas on that. And of course, we've got corrupt cuts through the administration, signing the treasuries, and so much for that.
Right.
say it on total realist. I don't want to, I mean, first I mentioned the two things we've got to have, secondary convictions on the location. Third, if there's a gross inequity and people aren't paying any tax, that's going to give us the radicals something to beat us over the head once we remove that. On the other hand, and this is the important thing I want to emphasize, I will not support any tax reform measure, which is demagoguery the other way, which basically makes a dude cheap points by kicking business around producers. Any tax reform that has the effect of in any way punishing unfairly producers in this country, the well producers or people that acquire wealth, I want to support.
I'm glad you say that,
because I just don't believe in it, and frankly, I'll take the heat on it, I know. But now you, there's going to be a tendency down there in the Congress for everybody to say, well, we got to kick the rich folks around. Hell, the rich folks, except for this business, that pay, you know, minimum and unfair advantage and so forth, or in any kind of a place where you can get wealthy people to get their money to all productive uses, that's a different thing. But just to kick the rich folks around because Woodcock thinks we ought to, I'm not for it.
Well, that's my view. Well, I'll ban this, but my temptation is to play a little bit of politics with this. They send us something to my house. It's totally irresponsible. I'm on that line. My temptation is to put something on our side, something that's equally irresponsible. I bought it as much demagogic as they do. The time to go to Congress and say, okay, I'll drop mine if you'll drop yours. So they put in something that's going to kick the living hell out of somebody and raise a $500 billion. I'd just like to put something in to raise about $500 million and kick the hell out of somebody else. So that I'm going to probably, well, you drop your, I'll drop mine. And oftentimes, that's one way to resolve some of those things. Sometimes you've got to answer a fool according to his folly. If you just, otherwise, they kind of put you in a position that we bought the finance committee. Are in here trying to look after vested interests. You recall some of the cartoons they had last time on the House, and I said so-called tax reform, but even before they were whittling away on the tax reform thing, so I was up like a pencil that long by the time we got through whittling away about a little double left. You see, well, sometimes we have to start thinking about the politics of this thing on our side. Now, Frank didn't hear the tax reform. Aside from this thing, I'm just saying, tighten up on the minimum income tax, in fact. I'm not upset by any specifically. But I would think it'd be the right thing to play that game to some extent. So if they put something irresponsible on their side, put something that you'd be responsible on our side. So go to Congress and drop the whole time. But the one thing I wanted to try to avoid, if I could head it off, be it your Secretary of Treasury or even you. That little fellow packed you in the corner like he did with that 1969 bill and make you agree to go along with a bunch of junk that you didn't really believe in.
That's all right.
Well, for example, I was 100% in favor of refusing the investment tax credit to recall. I thought we'd have heard too much about that. But that was a major item to slow down the economy and make you come back within a year and say, look, fellas, you've got to put this investment tax credit back into effect. And what we took away, half of the remaining reform had to do with changing the ways you take your depreciation allowance. And Connie had to give that back to him at the same time as and then of course they shot him, screamed, and gave it that way. He didn't see me doing that, but a bunch of them did. He changed the depreciation guidelines to give them back most of what we took away from the debt. So most of the rest of the stuff was just conversation. It just wasn't addressing. We didn't raise much money. And by the time Albert Quill got to hang his amendment on there, we lost a lot more than we brought in. It didn't help the government's fiscal position or anything.
And it didn't help Albert.
And it's something.
That's right.
Take a bite out of you for at least 10%. When we had that before, comes back to you. So tell you what you've done. Look at these great reformers. Paul Douglas, Al Gore, Fred Harris, Farrell, and every time you leave. Now, Fred is too good to get beat. He was too smart to run. So I don't think an election is bad about that. I said, charging and I raised somebody else's taxes. The advantage, I think, is this business fellow who didn't want to give somebody a tax cut, or else didn't want to raise people's taxes, unless it was, as you say, unless it's something that is just necessary, something that must be done.
You could go, or I thought it was, and I study this thing, make some judgments, but I'd like you to get you to talk in total confidence with George on this whole assignment.
That's the chairman's idea.
One little thing to see that I want to be sure that I understand. That's a dry old thing. But you have to treat me. The only corporation I own as a young lawyer, I said, I'm impressed by you. One of the few profitable corporations was Blue Trillium Companies. And it worked, it struck, but what about that dry old?
So 5,000 wells, most of which are marginal, only about 5,000, which are pretty good wells. You've got 300, if that's correct, if you've got 300,000 dry holes, you could just see a feeding that these other things have taken out trying to find oil. And of course, people want, but that's not the problem that most people know about. Some damn guy goes up there to the supplies of rest from somewhere, goes to some New York night spot. He's looking for some guy, some man to buy a lease from him, and it was some hot money, you might say, to cut down income taxes by October. And he's talked it up and lit it up, saying that this is a big tax giver. And those are the kind of people that give us a bad name and a bad reputation. And if you take the poor devil, who was out there?
Well, that's a drive. The kind of thing we ought to be trying to have. Yeah. These syndicated deals that are growing very fast.
Yeah.
It's an industry now.
Yeah.
It's a tax giving in this industry, and the accountants and lawyers are the ones who are getting rich off. But I think we could hit that.
And that thing could be drafted, I think, in such a way.
Against accountants and lawyers, Mr. President.
Well, I think you can draft it in such a way, too, that if this thing that the advantage goes to the general operator and does not go to the fellow who just in it for a tax advantage. Now, while you're at it, though, George, you better keep in mind, too, that you do want people to put money in.
Right.
In
the there are ways of, I think, well, let us talk about this.
You're talking. Now, let me come to one other subject.
I'm going to have to excuse myself.
Right.
Well, we're going to talk about that. We're going to trade now, anyway.
Right.
I'd like to brief this morning, so I'm going to
suggesting in our, trade thing, rather than moving in the area of a new county around where it's all, well, we're going to reduce tariffs around the world and so forth on a reciprocal basis, and then we'll have more trade, which we think is a good idea in many areas. What we're saying is, we of course will negotiate with the New York and with Japan on the barriers and so forth, but we have got to be in a position where we can go up as well as down. We don't have that position now.
Well, Mr. President, I don't think you're going to have enough weapons if we give you this. Now, if I could just tell you, sure, the experience I had back when I was George Wilson Johnson president, I was chairman of the United States, Henry Bauer picked me up the president's request and flew me down the ranch, and he told me at the time, and it looked to him, that the kind of deficit that we were running was something that you could not negotiate away. He said that in many respects, our deficit was the other guy's profit. And that,
speaking of trade deficit,
yeah,
not a national,
but about the
nation. Not so far,
we had, at that time, theoretically, we had a trade surplus, but not if you put the freight on the imports and took the foreign aid off your exports. You know? So he said that the kind of situation we were in, that you couldn't get out of that trap. It looked to him like you'd about $5 billion just in tire money, that you couldn't get out of that by negotiating that way, because those people weren't going to give you that much advantage. It seemed to him that the only thing he got out of it was by taking some action unilaterally and saying, here's what we're going to do, and after you do that, then negotiate from there. Well, he went to that conference, and I regret to say that the special trade representative and Dean Rusk were able to tell the president decided to let him negotiate. So I bet they managed to negotiate with about $500 million. That deficit, and even to try to get it over about $5 million. Now, since that time, I've become convinced that we had it completely within our tolerance to level off this trade deficit when we want to do it. But it's going to make some people mad, ask some people how you do it. But you're going to have to take some of the forceful type methods that John Connolly took in some of what you're talking about, but I think that you're going to have more tools than that. Now, here's the approach that appeals to me. You had Peterson down here saying that you ought to try to get every country to agree that what their objective should be would be to have a balance. Well, you can't get them to agree to that. There's Japan insisting that that's a plan protected to run a $12 billion surplus. At least half of it coming out of us. Now, how do you get those people, if they won't do it, how can you make them do it? It's obvious you can make them do it. You can do it from this end by saying, now here, and you can vary this. How do you want to vary it? But here's a tool you can use of it. You can say here, our balance of payments will not stand. This responsibility will not stand these continuous enormous deficits. So we're going to give people, you might say, a trading coupon for stuff they buy here. And every one of those trading coupons can be used put something into this country. So like some countries that have a deficit like Spain, they'll be tickled pink with it. Not that doesn't impede them for a second. They can even if they can find something to ship, they can ship us more. Or they can even sell to somebody, do some business with somebody who's got a deficit trading with us, at least somebody's got a surplus trading with us. Trade with them and put something in the head market, earn some dollars from France, let's say, and put those dollars back in here. If they want to Spain, to their purposes. And if you do it that way, you'd be saying to Japan, now here, if you did that to them at all, they'd be short by $5 billion this year on the tickets that you can put all their imports in the United States market. You'd say so, well, all right, now we're not going to make you have one ticket for $1,000 instead of $1,000, and we'll give you a 2-for-1 advantage. You've got $1,000 tickets, you can send $2,000 worth into it. But over a period of time, this thing has to come into balance. So you can say on your end that if we're going to make our exports and our imports come into balance, and need you to either take a system to do it. That's just a country board where I think it fits truly my idea. But that's one way you can do it. And of course, they can trade with third party countries. We have a deficit trading any Latin country, a lot of them have a deficit, they could buy something from those countries. chip thing in here. We had something along that line, just the other way around, on our oil import system. When you buy the petrochemicals, you know, we say that if you bring a ton, if you ship a ton of petrochemical products outside the country, we'll give you oil import tickets for a ton of imports. So that it gives you the effect of the world market price when you're producing to sell on the world market for your oil. That is the key to using the other thing, the other way around, you might say, to make those people buy from us in the event they want to sell us more. Now, I just think you're going to need some kind of a tool like that to have enough leverage, especially applying to guys who've got these big, big surpluses with us. Every time you put the surtax on, you have a whole bunch of guys who've got a deficit trading with us. And they come around and say, well, why do you want to do this to us? Stand right now. We're running a deficit in lots of things in the United States anyway. We're not your problems. If everybody's like us, you'd have a big surplus. I think that you need more flexibility and you need more power.
What about the surcharge for this? You see, he's got a good point. Remember, the Latins particularly basically went to that whole that surplus thing, that surcharge thing, and they were not the problem. It was the Japanese and to a certain extent some European and the Canadians. Now, can we, I mean, if we, of course, we applied it.
Symbol of the imbalance that is there, and that we're seeing the result of that now with this speculation.
state bill that would have put Preston in a very strong bargaining position, able to go to Japan and say, now, look, this situation has got to be straightened out. And if we can't do it together, I'm going to do it by myself. And here are the tools that I've got to do.
Well, that's the one thing I would observe by all means, Mr. President, if you try to, if you get yourself something.
And one thing was my cigarette. He feels very strong.